See. Yes, we're recording.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Jen, you
And
got to tell everybody they missed my great introduction on who I'm recording.
maybe we can. Oh, so just something so I don't forget, because I will. My wife and I, we live in Worcester, Massachusetts, and there's a wonderful women's shelter there that particularly is dedicated toward helping women and their children. And often I've had a lot of patients who have a lot of struggles with DCF and are separated from their children for various reasons, and it's really stressful for them. And so this women's shelter is particularly good at helping families stay together. And so if there's a local women's shelter here, Nick and Bob, or maybe somebody else can help me find that. So I'd really love to have any teacher Donna go to that women's shelter in Santa Cruz. And of course, please donate to the center too, because it looks like this is a wonderful place and it's wonderful to be here with you all this evening. Maybe we can just start with whether you've meditated for 50 years or 50 seconds, just taking a moment to just feel into your body and just feel it, stability of gravity holding us down. Just feeling down into what it feels like to be sitting or standing or whatever posture you're in. And if it's helpful, part of this, maybe finding what it feels like to breathe or simply rest in awareness of the body. Maybe even just noticing if there's any tension in the body that's being held over from the day, or any thoughts that keep swirling through. Just honoring, acknowledging those. Not trying to push them away or do anything, but just recognize that, oh, this is what's arising right now. Just noticing what grounding verb form is feeling like right now, grounding. And also just feeling into what it feels like to be together as a community, whether we're here virtually or we're here in person. Just noticing what it's like to be here together. One of my favorite snippets of a sutta is where the Buddha's cousin and attendant, Ananda, says, "Oh, this is Sangha is half of the holy life." And the Buddha says, "Don't say that. Don't say that, Ananda. It is the whole of the holy life." So just recognizing what it's like to be taking this time, this Friday evening, together, to be together. May this be for the benefit of all beings. So, as we gather together, can just be checking in with the body and the mind to see what's most helpful for you. So the eyes can be open, they can be closed. And what I'd like to do is just walk through some of the things that I've learned over the last few years that have really been a serendipitous journey of discovery for myself personally, but also some of the things that we've found in our laboratory and also in my clinic. And the hope is that what we talk about this evening can be helpful in even a small way to each of us. And so if there's something that resonates, just trust that the body and the mind will hold on to that. If there's something that doesn't, that's fine. Just notice it as words. And the general theme, as you might have seen, is really looking at how habits form and how we can work with them. And there's just this amazing parallel between the ancient Buddhist psychology and what we know in modern day that really can't be ignored, even as the reggae music in the background gets louder and louder.
Yeah.
So we'll see, reggae or Dharma? Reggae.
Yeah, all one.
That's right. They're all one. So just to set the scene, when I was in medical school, started meditating, found that it was helpful, and also realized that I had no idea how much I had no idea about how my mind worked. Many of you may have heard these levels of competence. It starts with unconscious incompetence and then goes to conscious incompetence and then conscious competence and then unconscious competence as we form habits with what we've learned. I was at the unconscious incompetence level for a long time, not even knowing that I didn't know how my mind worked. And then I started to realize how I didn't know how my mind worked. But that wasn't actually through medical school. I learned a lot of very different things in medical school, but not a lot around how my mind worked. And so as I was going through training, I had started meditating and sitting with the Sangha and started to learn. And I remember spending a lot of time trying to understand this very complex, to me, which seemed like a very complex and confusing concept called dependent origination. Just curious how many folks have heard of that. Okay, some folks, yeah.
Could you say the word again?
Sure, dependent origination. And this is... and is the, I don't know if I'm getting the microphone right. Can you all, in the cheap seats, can you all hear me? All right, good. Dependent origination, bring this up, and I'll bring it up again. But this is apparently what the Buddha was contemplating on the night of his enlightenment, dependent origination. So probably kind of important. And I remember going sometime in medical school, going on a weekend workshop with a monk. And just, he was unpacking it very, I think, very skillfully. And I say I think because I still couldn't understand it after like going through, there are these 12 steps and there's all this. I just couldn't understand why this was so important or how the Buddha got enlightened based on it. And as I was going through medical school and learning, you know, coming to that level of conscious incompetence, both, I started to get this real interest in becoming a psychiatrist, not because of all the great movies that portray psychiatrists as wonderful people. I can't think of a single one, actually, that does. They're either comedies or horror shows, you know, or they're the foil, you know, like, don't do this at home. But the I started to when I was working with starting to work more and more with patients, I started to notice this language that they were using. They were talking about craving, they were talking about clinging. And I'd heard that language before in my, you know, learning some of the Dharma, craving and clinging. And so I thought, wow, this can't be a coincidence. And so decided to become a psychiatrist against many people's advice. Somebody, one of my attending physicians actually told me I was going to waste my brain becoming a psychiatrist. But despite that, I went into the field and really didn't know exactly why, but just felt like I was drawn to do that. And so started my career clinically as a psychiatrist, but also becoming more and more of a neuroscientist. So I was doing clinical studies and then neuroscience studies, because at the time nobody had really done any like hardcore randomized trials showing things like mindfulness could actually help people with addictions. We just didn't know the answer to that. There was some early work done by Sarah Bowen and Neha Chawla in Alan Marlett's lab at University of Washington, but we really didn't know how well mindfulness could work for addictions. Yet, Four Noble Truths, the Buddha talks about craving, you know, talk about clinging, all this stuff, and this complex concept of dependent origination that I didn't really understand at the time was talking a lot about these things. And so long story short, I just took the plunge and started seeing how well mindfulness could actually help people with addictions. We started, our first study was when I was in residency, and we looked to see if we could help people with alcohol and cocaine use disorder. We found that mindfulness training was as good as gold standard treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy at the time, and in fact, help people work with individual stressors, which is a big cause of relapse for people. And so starting to learn, okay, there's something here. And then did a study with people who are trying to quit smoking, like another randomized controlled trial. And I mentioned those because that in medicine, at least, that's considered a gold standard treatment where you're comparing A to B and you're seeing if, you know, which one does better. They often call this a horse race because they're seeing which horse can win. We actually found that mindfulness training was 5 times better than gold standard treatment at helping people quit smoking. Blew me away because we were just hoping for a signal. That was a pretty clear signal. And in those studies, we started doing something really paradoxical, which was, and I pilot tested this in my clinic first, where my patients would come in. I was working at the VA hospital at the time. And patient would come in, want to quit smoking. They tried everything. And so I said, well, have you tried this? Why don't you go ahead and smoke? And they look at me like, my doctor just told me to smoke. Doesn't he know that smoking's bad for me? Yes, I know it's bad. They know it's bad. I don't need to remind them. But I said, why don't you pay attention as you smoke and let me know what you notice? And so a week later, they come back for a follow-up visit. Patient's going, they look at their cigarette and look at me and they'd be like, how did I not notice this? And what they were noticing is basically that cigarettes taste like crap. And as an example, I had a patient who'd been smoking for 40 years. He'd been smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. And so he had smoked roughly, ready for this? Roughly 290,000 cigarettes. 209. So he had reinforced this pathway 293,000 times. And he had no idea how he tried everything, couldn't quit. That's why he was coming to see me. But he comes back and he says, wow, these really taste pretty crappy. And so I mentioned that because that was that first hint that we had a signal for a mechanism. And this mechanism goes back to this mechanism of dependent origination. So how does that work? Well, there was in the year 2000, there was a neuroscientist named Eric Kandel. Any of you heard of him with a show of hands? Yeah. Okay. Not many folks. So he's a neuroscientist at Columbia, and he was studying sea slugs. And he studied sea slugs because they have one of the most basic nervous systems that's known. So you can actually like track every single neural synapse. It's like 20,000 neurons. It's not many. We have a lot more than that. Some of us, yes. And what he found was that sea slugs learn in very much the same way as humans. And what that means is that they were learning through the same process that was a very basic process that's called positive and negative reinforcement. And so if we look at, so what does that mean? What does positive and negative reinforcement mean? So a sea slug or even a single cell organism, like an amoeba, will move toward nutrient and it will move away from toxin, okay? So an amoeba is gonna move toward nutrient away from toxin, but it doesn't have a memory mechanism to like remember, oh yeah, nutrients here. But a sea slug does. It can remember, okay, here's a, you know, it can form memory, which is pretty cool. In humans, most of us can form memories as well. And so if you think of our ancient ancestors who didn't have refrigerators or Uber Eats or food delivery, you know, they had to remember where food was. And so they would go and forage for food, you know, the savannah, the woods, whatever. And when they found food, they would eat the food and, you know, assuming that it was not poison, their stomach would send this dopamine signal to their brain that said, remember what you ate and where you found it. And so that is the basis for what's called positive reinforcement. You need three elements to form that memory. You need a trigger, a behavior, and a result. And so seeing the food, trigger, eating the food, there's the behavior, and then the result was, or from a neuroscience standpoint, we call this a reward. It's reward-based learning. They get this dopamine signal that fires and says, hey, remember this. That's positive reinforcement. Negative reinforcement works the same way, but it helps us avoid something that's harmful. So it's like the amoeba moving away from toxin. Humans foraging, they see this saber-toothed tiger, whatever, there's the trigger, they run away, there's the behavior, and the reward is they don't become lunch. Okay, and so that's negative reinforcement. It is making something, avoiding something negative, if you think of it that way. So sea slugs learn this way, humans learn this way. And this process is the most basic way that we form habits. Most habits are actually extremely helpful for us. So imagine waking up every morning and having to relearn how to put on your clothes, how to walk, how to make coffee. You know, most of us probably wouldn't make it past breakfast because we'd be so exhausted. And so setting up habits is really, really helpful for being efficient as we go throughout our day. And so, I don't know, 95, 98% of our habits are actually really helpful. We don't even think about them. That's why they're called habits. You know, by definition, habits are automatic behaviors, behaviors we do without thinking. And we know, Eric Kendall and many others have shown that we learn through this positive and negative reinforcement process. Well, it turns out that there was a scientist that figured this out way before Eric Kendall. Some of you might have heard of the late teacher S.N. Goenka, who has formed these Goenka Vipassana centers all over the world. He called the Buddha a super scientist. and I think it's true, where the Buddha figured out this process of positive and negative reinforcement without sea slugs, without graduate students, without computers, without paper, right? He was around before paper was even invented. And so how did he do this? He sat down, you know, and it wasn't through deep absorption, concentration practices. He did that. That didn't get him enlightened. You know, he did all these austerities. Those didn't get him enlightened. He had, you know, earlier in life done all of the indulgence stuff. That didn't get him enlightened. But it was contemplating this process of dependent origination that did. And you know, about 10 years ago, a friend of mine, Jake Davis, who was a monk and then a Pali scholar, used to translate for Upamita. He and I started looking at, like, what exactly is dependent origination? How does that line up with positive and negative reinforcement? Because to me, there was something about these that they seemed very, very similar. And it turns out that, and we even, I mean, not that this is ground truth, but we wrote a paper and, you know, went through peer review suggesting that dependent origination was the first description of this process of positive and negative reinforcement. And the reason I mention that is because, one, it helped me get a clearer sense for what dependent origination was, because it was this really hard concept for me to understand. But pragmatically, I could start to get a grasp of it. And then also, I could start to see the power of it. So why is this so powerful? Why did this guy become enlightened contemplating this as compared to listening to reggae? Well, there wasn't reggae at the time, so maybe, who knows? So back to this, you know, the patients of mine in our smoking study that were starting to realize that cigarettes didn't taste very good. That, if you look at the suttas, there are a number of suttas where the Buddha actually describes this three-step process where he talks about gratification, he talks about danger, and he talks about escape. And there's a wonderful commentary written by Bhikkhu Bodhi in his anthology, like I think it's In the Buddha's Words, I think that's the title of his book, that really does a beautiful job of laying out what these suttas were talking about. The basic idea, the Buddha talked about, like, if we don't see how we get caught up in gratification, we're never going to escape. And there's a phrase from a sutta that I love where he says, not even if it rained gold coins would we get our fill of sense pleasures, right? Not even if it rained gold coins would we get our fill of sense pleasures. So he's highlighting how strongly bound we are to these things. And he suggested if we don't start paying attention to gratification, we're never going to escape its grip. There's even a term called the hungry ghost. Have any of you heard? Yeah, I see some heads nodding. So maybe Bob or others have talked about it, but imagine this ghost with this, not a particularly large mouth, but a very long, narrow esophagus and a huge belly. So no matter how much it eats, it can never fill up because it'll digest its food faster than it can get it in there to fill up the belly. So this phenomenon of the hungry ghost is like that saying about raining gold coins. Not even if it rained gold coins would we get our fill of sense pleasures. And so with gratification, we started asking this question, can we actually leverage this to help people escape? You know, to see the dangers of being caught up in this and then also escape. So there's another sutta that I'll basically summarize where the Buddha says, it wasn't until I explored gratification to its end that knowledge and vision arose. I hear some of you might have come across that. If I was only allowed, and I haven't read all of the suttas, but so with my limited knowledge, if I was only allowed to have like one phrase from all of the suttas that I've read, it would be that phrase. That's how powerful I think that is. So I'll repeat it. It wasn't until I explored gratification to its end that knowledge and vision arose. So why is that so powerful for me? Well, the Buddha was talking about reinforcement learning. He was talking about negative reinforcement. And so I started testing that in my clinic by having my patients pay attention as they smoked cigarettes. I wasn't saying, hey, this is the Buddha said this and explore gratification to its end, go. I was saying, just pay attention. What does a cigarette taste like? What's a cigarette feel like as that smoke's going into your lungs? What's it smell like as it's coming out? All that. And they would come, I've never had a patient come back and say, Dr. Brewer, thank you. I never realized how delectable a cigarette is. They would come back and say, how did I not notice this earlier? Soon. Well, it's a habit. You're not paying attention, right? So we know why. But that was so powerful for people because this exploring gratification to its end, this is where we start to shift. Because if we can no longer see that something is gratifying, it's not going to be rewarding for us and we're going to stop doing it. So the Buddha talked about disenchantment, becoming disenchanted with behavior. And I want to highlight that because what are we taught in modern day? Use your willpower, right? Whether it's Weight Watchers or anything else that somebody wants us to do, say just, you know, grit, you know, use your grit, you know, gird your loins, whatever, and use your willpower to change. You ready for this? Willpower is not in any of the equations in neuroscience for behavior change. I'm going to repeat that. It's not in the equations, right? So Eric Kandel gets the Nobel Prize. Nothing to do with willpower. There are these two researchers in the 1970s named Rescorla and Wagner. They came up with this reinforcement learning equation that is still used today. My lab still uses it because it's got really good explanatory power. Willpower is not in the equation. Okay. So we're being taught to, and this isn't just us in modern day. I mean, there have been debates for centuries about, you know, the passions of willpower versus the passions. Even in ancient Greece, there's a relief on the Parthenon with a horse and a rider, where the rider is the reason and the horse is the passions. Well, who's stronger? You know, it's the horse. And so we think that we can think our way out of, you know, old unhealthy habits, let's say. Yet there's actually no research that supports that. And for anybody that's tried themselves, they know how many times, you know, that somebody might get lucky and attribute it to willpower. And we can talk about that in the Q&A. Because often we think, oh, I did it through willpower. And we don't look to see if there is actually an underlying thing that we're attributing to willpower. But if you just go by the neuroscience, willpower is not in any of the equations. What is in the equations, actually, the critical ingredient is awareness. That's it. They're actually pretty simple. You know, this is like the E equals MC squared of behavior change. It's only three variables. And there's a variable called an error term that determines whether the reward value in somebody's brain is going to change. And so if something is no longer rewarding, if we are disenchanted with it, we are going to naturally be less likely to do it. So for example, with smoking, somebody sees that a cigarette tastes like crap. They can't unsee that. I think of this often for people as a Santa Claus moment. You know, if you have kids, or maybe some of you still believe in Santa, so close, you know, block your ears for this one. But, you know, it's like the kids believe in Santa Claus up to a certain point, and then, you know, they're at the mall and they grab onto the beard and the parents are like, oh, because you can't go back. The gig is up. And that is also true when we see what a cigarette tastes like. It is also true when we really pay attention and see what, for example, overeating feels like. We did a study in my lab where we had an app called Eat Right Now that had, we have this tool that we could build into it and study how quickly that reward value changes by having people pay attention as they overeat. And again, nobody came back and said, oh, thank you. Overeating feels so good. It only takes 10 to 15 times of somebody doing that for that reward value to drop below zero, 10 to 15 times, which makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, because we don't have 15 times to be chased by the saber-toothed tiger to learn that it's dangerous. We actually have to learn things pretty quickly. And the more we pay attention, the faster we learn. So that one critical ingredient is awareness, right? I think of it as with the attitudinal component, I think of it as curiosity. When we're being curious or when we're bringing a beginner's mind to a situation, we can really see without judgment whether something's helping us or not helping us. And so my patients were seeing cigarettes didn't taste good. They weren't helping them. They knew that they were expensive and that they were harming their health, but that was intellectually. They were starting to feel this and experience it directly. Patients with who are overeating, they were starting to experience it directly. And so the way I think of this is that our feeling body is much stronger than our thinking brain. And in this way, we could start to leverage what the Buddha was talking about way back in the day, which is start by exploring gratification to its end. And so we did, over the course of several years, we did a number of, we did a lot of experimentation with qualitative studies, just asking people that were going through our programs, like, how was their behavior changing? Because we were seeing that, you know, people were quitting smoking, people were cutting down on their eating, like overeating or craving related eating. We'd even developed a program for anxiety and found that in a randomized controlled trial, we could get a 67% reduction in anxiety by having people pay attention and get curious, because anxiety can actually be driven like a habit. I didn't learn that in medical school. But there was a researcher in the 1980s that ironically put this idea out at the same time, right around the same time that Prozac was released. So nobody heard about him. I know, what a travesty. But his name is Thomas Borkenbeck. And his theory about, you know, worry driving anxiety through negative reinforcement is very powerful, to the point where we studied it and got the 67% reduction in anxiety by having people pay attention and see how rewarding worry was, exploring gratification to its end. So a lot of people associate worrying with all sorts of things, but when they really looked at the cause and effect relationship, worrying didn't feel good and was just driving more anxiety. And so if they could see that and bring curiosity in, they could start to learn to be with the feeling of anxiety with curiosity, bringing that curious awareness in instead of distracting themselves with worry. And that was helping them kind of break free from that negative reinforcement cycle of anxiety and worry. So exploring gratification to its end turns out to be extremely, extremely powerful. And it only needs one thing, which is awareness. And so when we were doing these qualitative studies, we started to see a pattern. And it turns out to be three steps. I don't know why things come in threes in this world, but this is yet another example of that. The first step was people just starting to map out these habit loops, right? These positive or negative reinforcement habit loops. So they could start to identify what's the trigger, what's the behavior, what's the result. And what we found was we could even simplify that more, just have people identify what the behavior was. So for example, if somebody snacks at night or they stress eat, just starting to recognize, oh, am I reaching for food because I'm hungry or because I have an urge to eat? You know, or is it a habit? Are they reaching for a cigarette, you know, because they're going through withdrawal from their nicotine or whatever? Are they worrying? So mapping out whatever the habit loop is turns out to be the first step. The second step is really leveraging this exploring gratification to its end. So asking the simple question, what am I getting from this? Not intellectually, but feeling into their direct experience, asking, what am I getting from this? This has pretty interesting parallels, again, with this concept of dependent origination. And the idea here is that if we explore gratification to its end, what am I getting from this? We start to become disenchanted. And if you look at some of the links of dependent origination, there's one where feeling tone, vedana, So pleasant and unpleasant feeling tones and neutral to some degree will lead to craving. So if something's pleasant, we crave more. That's where positive reinforcement comes in. If something's unpleasant, we crave less of it. We want it to go away. That's negative reinforcement. And that craving leads to the next step, which can be, so the word is upadana. It can be translated as clinging, but it can also be translated as sustenance. And the sustenance, when I heard that, I'm not a Pali scholar, but when I read about this, I thought that was really interesting because there are a lot of fire analogies used in the suttas. And craving is often described as a fire. And so if we have a craving, that fuel need, that fire needs fuel. And so if you think of sustenance as being that fuel, every time, like, for example, somebody has a craving for a cigarette and they smoke a cigarette, they've just added a log to that fire. They've just fueled that next round of craving. And so if we notice the craving and we notice that we're feeding it and we realize that this is not actually helping me, we become disenchanted and we are naturally drawn to pull that fuel away from the fire. And as we pull that fuel away, the fire dies down on its own naturally. Again, no willpower involved. The Buddha didn't talk about willpower here. So we can start to see how as we, one, map out these habit loops, two, start to explore gratification to its end and see, ask, what am I getting from this and become disenchanted with behaviors, this leads to this third step. And just seeing if there's anything else with the second step, we'll move on. And then I'll also make sure that there's plenty of time for questions in case any of this is confusing. Once we become disenchanted, our brains are set up with these reward hierarchies and going to say, okay, this used to be good. It's not so good. Give me something better. And so I think of this as finding that bigger, better offer. And I mentioned curiosity before, bringing awareness in. That can really be helpful for developing disenchantment. Can curiosity itself become the new behavior? Can it be more rewarding than these old behaviors? So for example, and we've done studies with this, if somebody has anxiety, for example, and their old habit is to worry, they can ask, well, how does worry feel? Or they can start bringing in curiosity and ask, oh, what does anxiety feel like in my body? And so I think of it pragmatically as shifting from the, oh no, as they start to worry, to, oh, what does this anxiety feel like? And when they do that, curiosity uniformly feels better than worrying. We can do the same comparison between curiosity and craving. Which one feels better, trying to resist a craving versus getting curious about the craving? And so we can start to see curiosity itself feels pretty good. And just bringing in curiosity helps us step out of these old habit patterns. We don't have to do anything, but we can start to learn, oh, these are physical sensations. These are thoughts. These are emotions. They come and go. And that curiosity helps us be with those rather than do something to avoid them or make them go away or change them in some way. A couple of great quotes that I love where one attributed to Marcus Aurelius, where he says, what stands in the way becomes the way. And so here, if we have anxiety, if we have an old habit of trying to make it go away or worry about it, we're running away from that anxiety. But here we have this anxiety. So that's what's standing in our way. What if that becomes the way by getting curious? So what do I mean? Why do I say, how could this become the way? Well, when we start to bring that awareness to the anxiety itself, we can start to notice different things about it. Like, oh, it's physical sensations. Oh, it changes in characteristic. Oh, it's made up of thoughts and physical sensations. These thoughts change as well. So we can start to learn some of these core characteristics of existence that, yes, the Buddha talked about before paper was invented. So we start to get into the territory of, impermanence. These thoughts come and go. We start to get into the territory of not self, because we often think, oh, I am an anxious person. And we can start to step back and realize, oh, I'm a person who has anxiety. So we're not identified with that mental state of anxiety anymore. We can do the same thing with craving for cigarettes or food or whatever the habit is. We can start to see how we're identified. And the disidentification comes through that exploration of gratification to its end. And then finding that it actually feels better not to be identified. I'm going to say that again, because that can be pretty scary for a lot of people until they see, you know, if they're like, oh, this not self thing. Wow, that's pretty scary. Well, what if we approach it from the lens of, wow, when I'm identified with being an anxious person, that's actually painful. That causes suffering. When I take at least the next step to say, well, I'm a person who has these feelings of anxiety, that makes it a little easier to be with and handle and hold. So here we can start to make this progression that the Buddha predicted in his, you know, science of the day that is now backed up by modern day neuroscience and you know, some of the clinical studies my lab's done and other labs have done. But pragmatically, we can start to see that it's not necessarily an easy process, but it's relatively simple. We don't have to memorize all 12 links of dependent origination. If you ask me, I'm not sure I have them all in my head, some of the key steps. But we can start to see pragmatically how we can put this into use in our own lives, because we can start to bring forward, like noticing when we're caught up in some type of suffering. Oh, what am I identified with? Is it, you know, is this a habit? Then we can start to ask, what am I getting from this? Right? Not intellectually, but feeling into this and feeling into the power of the feeling body. You know, the feeling body is much stronger than the thinking brain. As we become disenchanted with old habits, we can start to also become enchanted with helpful habits, such as being curious, bringing curious awareness in, instead of jumping to conclusions in a conversation. It can be that simple. Oh, trying to understand somebody's perspective instead of assuming or judging them for the way we think that they think, or that whatever their ideas are, you know, bad or good. We can also start to notice so I think of curiosity kind of as a superpower, because it can really help us unravel some of these ways that we're identified with our experience. Another superpower that I think can be extremely helpful, especially in the West, is kindness, where we can start to notice how often we're caught up in self-judgmental habit loops, right? We're taught to judge everything in the West, especially ourselves. And so we can start to recognize, oh, I'm judging myself. Start to ask, what am I getting from this judgment, this self-judgment? How does it feel? And then we can compare that to kindness. Which one feels better? Right? It's a no-brainer. Our brains are going to pick kindness every time. Again, same process of unraveling. It starts with awareness and then asking ourselves, what am I getting from whatever this is? You know, this self-judgment, for example. And then substituting, starting to explore kindness instead. I think the last thing I'll say here, and then I'll talk a little bit about some of the neuroscience that relates, and then open it up for discussion. I'm not sure if there's anything else that I need to say here, but just to bring it back to this idea of dependent origination, I would just want to highlight there's another kind of offshoot of what the Buddha was contemplating on the night of his enlightenment. He said that the dependent origination could actually account for a lot of things, including karma. Many, at least the way that I've heard and understood karma, is kind of cause and effect, right? Cause and effect, cause and effect. Well, what does that mean? And what does that mean pragmatically for us in our everyday lives? Well, if you look at reward-based learning or this reinforcement learning process, it's about the behavior cause and the result, effect. If something's rewarding, we're going to keep doing it. If it's not rewarding, we're going to stop. And so he was actually, the Buddha was saying, this is karma. And so if we keep being a jerk and we think that that's rewarding, that's going to feed the process. If we're a jerk and we see that it's actually harming other people and ourselves, then we become disenchanted. And that karma starts to shift in that moment, right? Where we're going to become disenchanted and less likely to do it. So we can see that there's a lot of explanatory power, whether you look at the ancient Buddhist psychology or you look at the modern day psychology, that's really lining up. But most importantly, that it lines up in a way that we can actually use this for the development of our own wisdom, so that we can step out of the habits that are causing our own suffering and the suffering of others, and we can step into habits that are enriching our lives and helping others. So we can start to form, you know, if it's eating junk food versus eating healthy food, we can see which habit is helping us stay alert and awake. If, you know, kindness, I already talked about that. That's another example. So the last thing I'll mention just for a few minutes is that we've done a fair number of neuroscience studies to kind of just understand how meditation affects the brain, how mindfulness affects the brain. I won't go into all of those. And, you know, for a lot of people, neuroscience or science in the West is kind of a new form of religion. They're like, oh, but I saw it on the news and it was a scientific study, so it must be true. Obviously, as a scientist, I think science is helpful, but I think we also have to be pragmatic and keep in mind, like, how is this helping me in my life right now? And so I'll only focus on the pieces that are actually helpful. And if you want to read about the esoteric brain activity stuff, I'm happy to share any of the papers that we've written about it in some other books as well. So we did our first study with experienced meditators back in 2011, or when we published it. So we started doing this a couple of years before that. And the basic question we wanted to ask was, how is a meditator's brain different than a non-meditator's brain? And naively, I went into this study thinking there must be some brain region that's activated, because at the time, it sure seemed like meditation was hard work for me. Since then, I've changed my tune. I think curiosity is the superpower that's the driving force behind everything from concentration to insight. But at the time, this is when I would go to the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts in the winter, and when it was cold, and I would sweat through t-shirts in the middle of, you know, in the winter, because I was working so hard to meditate. And so I was like, well, we're going to find that brain region that must be very big in my head right now, because it seems like I'm working a lot. Long story short, we almost thought we had a failed experiment, because we couldn't find a single brain region that was increased in activity in experienced versus novice meditators. But we did find something completely unexpected, which is that experienced meditators were decreasing activity in certain brain regions that novices were not. And this is in a network called the default mode network, because this is what we tend to default to, like 50% of waking life, according to some studies. And that default mode network, you can think of this as the me network, because it's about self-referential processing. We're thinking about ourselves, even if we're not consciously like, you know, I'm doing this. So often, about 50% of waking life, the average person is thinking about the past, thinking about the future, and they're in that narrative. This is the network that also gets activated when people crave all sorts of things, ranging from cigarettes to cocaine to gambling to chocolate. It's activated. It also gets activated when people ruminate a lot, you know, when in depression. It gets activated when they worry a lot with anxiety. Long story short, we found that this network, in particular, two hubs of this network, were deactivated in experienced meditators. And we went on to, so who cares? Because that doesn't really help, you know, us. What does help us is we went on to do some what are called neurophenomenologic studies, where we could link up people's subjective experience with their brain activity. And what we could do there was ask, well, what's actually going on when they're deactivating these brain regions? And what we found was that when people activate this network, it tends to be associated with being people getting caught up in their experience. So if they get caught up in a craving or get caught up in worry, that contracted feeling is associated with increased activity in this brain network. In contrast, as people were getting deeper into meditation or just being curious, this network was getting quiet, and they were reporting that this was effortless and it's more of an expansion in experience. And so the pragmatic, the useful aspect of what I'm talking about here is not that there are certain brain regions or this or that, but it points to something in our experience that can be very helpful. We can start to notice when we're getting caught up in our experience, like when we're feeling closed down or contracted. And we can just ask ourselves, how does that feel? And then we can compare that, and we can also look to see, what am I doing that's leading to this contraction, right? Cause and effect. Am I getting frustrated? Am I feeling contracted? In contrast, we can start to notice, well, what's it like when we bring curiosity in those moments? Does that help us open up? And we can think of that opening, that expansion, as helping us move away from this contracted sense of this is me toward a more expanded, at least expanded view at first, and then more expanded experience of what's it like not to be holding on to this self as much. And you can extrapolate from there, hold on less, and we might actually notice the joy that comes from letting go of that concept of self. So the marker of contraction versus expansion can be a very helpful, think of it as a mindfulness bell to help us say, oh, I'm feeling contracted. What is leading to that? So that we can start to link up, you know, whether it's whatever the behavior is and how it feels, so that we naturally start to see, oh, that's kind of painful. Just like my patient realizing that cigarettes don't taste very good. And at the same time, when we're feeling expanded, we can pause and ask, oh, what's the cause of this? Is there joy? Is there kindness? You know, you can even think in the realm of the Brahma Viharas, these four immeasurables, right? Is there joy happening, this boundless joy? Is there kindness happening? Is there compassion happening? Or is there something else happening that's leading to this opening? And then we can ask, how'd that feel compared to the closing? So that we naturally start moving in the direction. And I don't say that this is something we have to train ourselves to do. This is something we actually did a study where people naturally prefer the expansion to the contraction. And so it seems that our brains are actually naturally wired, not only for kindness, because it's more open than being mean to each other, but for not holding on to a self-concept. So that's good news. It can feel like we're swimming upstream a lot, trying to become enlightened or awakened or whatever. But what this suggests is that we can actually start to notice how painful it is to be caught up in ourselves, in our self-concepts. And that by noticing that, that's going to naturally help us kind of flow downstream toward awakening on its own, by just harnessing these powers that we already have of curiosity and kindness as general categories. So that's plenty, I think, to talk about this evening. You know, it's like 20 years of research in 45 minutes or whatever. So what I'd like to do is just open it up to questions and discussion to make sure that this isn't just some like, oh yeah, he talked about science, so, you know, who cares? So that we all can leave this, you know, leave tonight with some nugget that's going to help us foster kindness, foster curiosity, and with those seed crystals, help those grow in the world in ourselves, in our Sangha, and then spread beyond that. Because that's, I think that's really the only way we're going to make it through this together. So I want to thank you all for your attention, and would be happy to open it up to questions. And I think I can, I don't know if there were questions in here. I'm looking for the chat box, but why don't we start with the folks that are here, please.
I might have missed this, but could you define dependent origination in just a couple sentences?
I'll repeat that for folks who might not have heard it. Can you define dependent origination in just a couple of sentences? Short answer is no, I can. I'm going to defer that question to Bob, because he probably could answer that better than I can. Bob, could you define it?
Something from my teacher, Tom Pulisetto. He would say, if you know, it can break the cycle. If you don't know, you go around and around.
That is awesome. So I'll repeat it into the microphone. Tell me if I've got this right. If you know, you can break the cycle. If you don't know, you keep going around and around. So this is samsara, endless wandering. So he says, if you know what?
If you know the cycle,
if you know the cycle.
Fairness, curiosity. Mm-hmm.
So if you know, can I say, if you know how the cycle works?
Yeah.
Is that fair to say? Okay, great. So here's my definition. I'm just kidding. Kidding. Yeah. This is something I love this because I'm just feeling that, right? If we know how the cycle works, then we can be free. We can step out of it. And that's where and if we don't know, we will continue endless wandering in that cycle of suffering. And so, does that answer your question?
Well, yes, it does quite a bit.
Thank you, Bob.
About awareness, curiosity. But the words dependent origination don't jive with what Bob said.
Yeah.
This is a semantic question, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. And so the short answer is, if you look at, this might not be a short answer, hopefully it is. If you look at the suttas that talk about dependent origination, they're set up to say, this is dependent on this. Okay. This is dependent on this. So when this arises, this arises. So for example, when feeling tone arises, then craving arises. Craving is dependent on feeling tone.
Pleasant.
Yeah, pleasant or unpleasant. When you have craving, the next one is upadana, is clinging or sustenance. Sustenance is dependent on craving. If there's no craving, there's no clinging. And that's important because the Buddha also talks about how that unravels, right? If this isn't there, then this isn't there. So that's, I think, the importance of this being described as dependent arising, or sometimes people call it dependent co-arising. Because if we don't have sustenance, then craving will cease. So if we don't feed the fire burns down. That's the way I think of it. And then Bob's nodding, so I think I'm on the right track. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, well, don't think too much, because this is really, yeah.
But the words dependent origination,
Yeah, it is. And it's probably lost in translation. That's my guess. Because this is, this was a spoken language that was also, these suttas were, before they were written down, apparently they were recited in certain ways so people could remember them. So, there's a lot of repetition, a lot of stuff, just so that you can, that helps people memorize things. And so that can make things even more confusing.
You just said it very clearly, that dependent origination is the trigger and then the behavior from the trigger.
Yeah,
yeah. I understand what it is.
That, yeah.
That dependent origin, the origin is the trigger.
Yeah. 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 If I'm a jerk, I suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so that's something. And if we can be aware, like Bob was saying, if we can be aware that this is the cycle and that we're feeding it, right? spinning the wheel, then we can stop spinning. We can stop adding fuel to that wheel spinning.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, yes. Did you have a question?
My question is this. I know a bunch of people who both are either obese overeaters or alcohol and drugs, and they say it's self-punishment that feeds me. I don't buy it. I see it as a pleasure-driven problem, but maybe I'm wrong. They all seem to believe, and I just hold it, that it's self-punishment. So either way, can you talk thematically about what you're saying in relation to that?
Mm-hmm. So
thank you.
Self-punishment can come in very many forms, but the... Sure. So the question is, there are people, the observation is that there are people that might be at an unhealthy weight because they overeat. They might drink alcohol more than is helpful for them. And they say that it's self-punishment. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
But either way, whether it's self-punishment or pleasure.
Or indulgence, yeah. So what drives that, whether it's indulgence or self-punishment? Let's start with the self-punishment piece, because this can often seem confusing. So from a habit formation standpoint, when somebody does something and then they beat themselves up or do something as quote-unquote self-punishment, that can be traced back to a feeling of control. Oh, I can do something about this. I can beat myself up. I have some control over that. So that's one. There's one other that is now escaping my brain. So they do this as self-punishment. And we'll see if the second one comes back up. But that feeling of, I'm sorry?
Third one is trauma.
Yeah, well, and we can talk about how trauma plays a role in this as well. But if we look at this feeling of control, that can be rewarding because it feels better to have control than not control, even if it's just an illusion of control. The second piece is that it's familiar. And so, you know, it's that devil that I know versus the devil that I don't know. Our brains generally prefer things that they can predict. Architecture real estate is set up for predicting the future. And because if we can predict the future, we can predict what's going to help us survive. And so our brains will look to try to minimize uncertainty. Uncertainty does not feel good. And that does not feel good can sometimes outweigh the does not feel good of self-punishment. This is also where a lot of people stay or gravitate toward abusive relationships, because it's what is familiar to them, even though it's not helpful. And so I'd say those are two of the drivers that I see a lot. And there certainly could be that, you know, the sense pleasure piece in there as well.
When with your theory or your research, then the uncoupling, are you saying just being aware that familiarity drives it is enough to uncouple it, or are you saying something beyond it, that?
So that knowing that those are driving forces can help unwind those. So if we know that illusion of control is spinning that cycle of suffering, then we can start to ask, how rewarding is this? Oh, it's not very rewarding. If we can know that stepping out of our comfort zone by definition is going to feel not comfortable, knowing that can help us ask, if when I step out, am I actually stepping into danger, or am I stepping just out into something different? And so I'll often have people ask the question, is this dangerous or is this different? To help them work with their brain that's saying, hey, danger could be out there. And then they can say, no, this isn't dangerous. This is just different. This is out of my comfort zone. And the curiosity can help with that quite a bit, so that instead of moving into their panic zone, they can move into their growth zone. And ideally, as we start to become more comfortable and familiar with curiosity and see how powerful it is, we can start to live in our growth zone as our new habit. So that, you know, we're like, oh, that's different as compared to, oh, no, that's different. You know, and that could be our new default.
So I just want to clarify what you think, because it seems like familiarity is rewarding. So it's only through some magical desire to do it differently that they are actually having to step out of their reward, the familiarity reward, into a known, which is now it's rewarding.
So let me see if I can repeat that and then I'll address it. So that, you know, the known is rewarding. And so what's it going to take to help us step out of the comfort zone? Mm-hmm. The familiarity. Yeah. Yeah. So some of it is that there's got to be some driving force that says this comfort zone is not helping me enough, is causing enough suffering that I need to move. Yeah. And that can come from exploring gratification to its end. Like, what am I getting from being in this, whatever this comfort zone is? And it can also come where they're starting to realize, wow, this is not working for me. And so that can be a natural driver. On top of that, the more we develop curiosity, that can help develop more of a differential. And I didn't mention this in the talk, but it's important. There are two ways that we can shift reward hierarchies. One is becoming disenchanted with old behaviors, but also becoming more enchanted with new behaviors. And it's really about the differential as compared to the absolute value. So if we can shift this a little bit and shift this a little bit, this is the same as shifting this a lot. And so this is really helpful because sometimes we don't feel like we can work with this piece, but we can start to develop curiosity. We can start to develop kindness. And the more we build those, the more of a differential will naturally start to happen. Okay. Yeah. Which is good news. Right. This is all good news. I'm preaching the good news. Yes, please.
A question sort of along that lines too, where if it's something like smoking, I could see it easier to build that differential in a sort of a more immediate effect of, oh, these cigarettes taste bad. Mm-hmm. Or I think that's a more kind of clear example of something that might not be desirable. And I'm curious how you approach cases where there's not as much of a differential, or it's like temporarily displaced, where in the moment that might all feel good or fine, or not having a more kind of clearly identifiable, this tastes bad, but it's not until like the next day that,
yeah. Yeah.
That it's like, oh, I really wish I had not done that. Or
yeah, it's a good question. So let's, and I'll see if I can repeat it for folks on Zoom. So pointing out that cigarettes, we can notice right away, cigarettes don't taste good. And so we've got that immediate feedback. And that's actually really important, that the closer to the immediate experience that we get feedback, the more we're going to learn. So if we look a day out, there's a lot of things that have happened. So it's hard to correlate what we did as a causal element in what the result is. So the closer it can be, the more we learn. So two examples, and we don't have to smoke to survive. It's actually an anti-survival mechanism, right? Or strategy. So let's look at something different, like, yes, yeah. Eating. So we have to eat. Thank you. That's perfect. So we have to eat to survive. How's that work? Well, we can look at the type and the amount of food that we eat. So with ice cream, which is, to me, delicious, I can start to look at how much I eat and when I eat. And I can start to notice. So, for example, worked with a lot of people who struggle with binge eating. And so they'll go totally numb when they're binging, right? And it's like when the dust storm settles, which is often the next day, so if they're binging at night, they're like, wow, that was pretty awful. They can generally link that up. It was because of the binge, not because of the bad television show that they watched while they were binging or whatever. And they can start to link that up. And as long as they can feel into what it feels like afterwards, they can still learn from it. We use this analogy of gears, like bicycle or car, like first, second, third step is like gears, because you can you know, you can shift between different gears. So I call this retrospective second gear, where we can look after we've done something and we can still learn from it. We don't have to go back and repeat it. And as long as we can feel into the direct experience through our memory, then that's going to give us good learning power with that. So let's go back to the ice cream. So if we, and we can even double click on that, where we can start to look at each bite of ice cream. So if we're eating ice cream when we're starving versus when we're full, we can start to notice same ice cream, it's going to taste delicious when we're really hungry, and it's still going to taste good, but not as delicious when we're not, because our brain says, hey, you're not hungry. And so we can actually map that out in what we call the pleasure plateau. So with each bite, you know, even with dinner, same food, where it's going to be less and less tasty. And so we hit that plateau where our brain's like, hey, you've had enough, especially if we don't eat it very quickly. It takes about 15 minutes to register satiety. If we don't pay attention, we can go off that cliff of overindulgence, whether it's ice cream or dinner or anything. And so we can notice, like with ice cream, like, oh, what feels better to eat some ice cream, right, for dessert versus eating a lot if we tend to have a habit of overeating it. And so here's something, you know, it's not going to make ice cream taste less good, especially if we're curious, it might even taste better, right? How many of us have been eating ice cream and we're craving that next bite while we've got ice cream in our mouth? That's a wasted bite of ice cream. We've just wasted that because we're not tasting it. And it doesn't even feel good to crave that next bite because it's like that itchy urge that says do it. So here, if we just pay attention, you don't even do this slowly. You just have to pay attention with what's happening right here. We can find that pleasure plateau, for example, with food. It's a little more challenging with intoxicants like alcohol because they're intoxicants. We can't pay attention by definition when we're intoxicated. And so that's where we have to look afterwards. And so that's, you know, so I don't tell my patients, yeah, have that second drink mindfully, have that third drink mindfully. What I have them determine is like, when can you stop? When do you lose your awareness? And it's usually after close, either half or a full, it's not a lot of alcohol, where they start to lose that ability to be aware. And then they can look afterwards and see where it's not helpful for them. And it's different for everybody. But does that get at your question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yes. And hold on 1 second. I just don't want to neglect our folks on Zoom. I just noticed there was a red 10 and they're good at bringing your attention to things that you haven't paid attention to. So let me just see what's in the chat. Hi, Bob. Can you please unmute? I think we've taken care of that one. So I'm going to answer one or two here, and then we'll come back to this. So somebody says, is this similar to what B.F. Skinner in the 1950s and 60s called operant conditioning? Yes, this is operant conditioning. Another one, what about when exploring the habit leads to deeper enchantment rather than disenchantment? Good question. Oh, for example, someone who studies and sees how much they enjoy the feeling. Mm-hmm. The feeling of drinking alcohol. So I might have touched on that a little bit. This is for Marco or Marcos or somebody. A name that
she's waving on.
Oh, thank you. Yes. So you can also unmute yourself and ask, if I haven't touched on it with the alcohol piece, let's get into that a little more so I can make sure I'm understanding your question. So please.
I think you did touch on it, but what about in the studying when it's like, ooh, they feel the pleasure that much more? You touched on it, but that could just be a greater enchantment. I do this work with clients with different substances, so I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I haven't found any of my patients or clients have actually started using more or drinking more.
But maybe staying with it, right? If they're not going to give it up. I agree with the not doing more, but what about saying, oh, well, but a small amount feels really good.
Yeah. And if a small amount feels really good and they're not disenchanted, they're not going to change the behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, okay. And if it's a small amount, it's probably less likely to be causing some type
right.
of
sure.
suffering that's enough to get them to stop.
Right.
This is where, and you may do this as well, I love motivational interviewing,
mm-hmm.
which for folks that aren't familiar with it, the basic, you can I summarize it in one sentence. Miller would probably kill me for this, but asking somebody, why not smoke more? Somebody's wanting to quit smoking. I said, well, why don't you smoke more? And they look at me again, like, who's this crazy guy telling me to smoke and smoke more? But it helps them feel into the disenchantment that they've gotten already. And it helps them articulate that more in their own experience. So that's why I love motivational interviewing, or at least the principle of it. So, and maybe, yeah, thumbs up. Good. Thank you. And thank you for the question. Okay, please.
Have you studied these practices of paying attention and curiosity in dealing with chronic pain? Mm.
We haven't done those. So I'll repeat it. Have we done these studies with people with chronic pain? I have not, but there have been a lot of other people that have. In fact, this is how Jon Kabat-Zinn made a name for himself, and you're nodding your head. But for folks that aren't aware, back in the 1970s, Jon Kabat-Zinn was working at UMass Medical School, and he would go around to all the clinics and ask for their most challenging patients who had refractory pain. And he'd find them everywhere. And so he started teaching them what is now called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And the idea there was to help people. It's not going to change the physical experience of pain, but it's going to change somebody's relationship to it. And the way I think of this, maybe you've heard of Shinzan Yang. Are you familiar? Yeah. So for those of you that aren't familiar with Shinzan Yang, he's very mathematical in the way he teaches. Lovely, brilliant. And so he had this equation that I absolutely love, is suffering equals pain times resistance. Okay. So I'm not particularly mathematically inclined, but even I can understand this equation. It's much easier than dependent origination. In the sense that the pain is proportional to suffering, but so is the resistance. And so the pain might not change, and we might not have control over the pain, but we do have control over how we relate to the pain. That's the resistance. And I think of the inverse of resistance as curiosity. So the more we get curious and go, instead of going, here's pain, oh no, how long is this going to last? Is it going to get worse? Is it going to be, all the stories around the pain? We can go, oh, how am I relating to this pain? It's not going to necessarily make, pain suddenly start sprouting rainbows and unicorns, but it can help. And John showed this, and others have shown this as well. It can really help us change the experience of pain. So people report, they actually report lower levels of pain, even though the physical pain probably hasn't changed. It's because they're resisting it less. They're getting curious. They're bringing that curiosity in more. So I don't know if that gets at your question, but it's been really helpful for a lot of people, especially, in modern days where we've got an opioid epidemic with a lot of people struggling with, medications that truly do reduce the experience of pain. And then those are getting taken away from them now because of all sorts of stuff that's not great. So anything else you want to add to that?
I'm also aware of like these functional MRI studies that show that the pain areas that are lighting up really can get reduced.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's somebody that wrote a very interesting book called The Way Out, I think. Yeah. Alan Gordon. So that book is worth reading, where he worked with Tor Wager, who's a very smart neuroscientist who did all these imaging studies where they would basically bring in, I would say, things that are at least mindfulness adjacent, if not directly related to helping people relate to their pain differently. And so the brain areas that are interpreting the experience of pain are showing changes in activity, suggesting that their experience, in how they're interpreting pain is changing. They haven't changed anything physically in their body, but it's that relationship. And that just shows how important that relationship is. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
And Jed, I had an adolescent tell me, everything times zero is zero. So even if the pain is five and I times it by five, my suffering is 25. But if my resistance is zero, five times zero is zero. Zero. And I don't suffer. And this kid is schooling me on that. It's true.
I love that. Did folks did you all hear that? Yes. Great. Thank you. That's wonderful. Anything times zero is zero. So we
there's no resistance. There's really no suffering. There's still pain, but there's not suffering.
Yeah, no resistance, no problem.
Yeah.
I love it. And that's what is it? Is it Ajahn Chah? No self, no problem. Yeah. But that's related because it's this story we have where we're identified with. And when you're identified there's going to be resistance. When we're not identifying, that resistance drops. And if you anything times zero is zero. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Is it? Yes, please.
I have a question, but I see that Sheila had her
hand up. Oh, thank you. Sheila, please. I hope your hand is not tired from having it raised so long. You can you unmute yourself?
Oh, you've answered my question. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you.
It was about Skinner.
Oh, great. Great.
Thanks.
Ice cream.
He answered my ice cream question. But I have a question just about, I guess it's kind of a two-parter, but I'm curious about the research that we've done, the diversity of the subject, and then any correlation, or any thoughts you have on people who identify differently than white cis het folks
in
this type of work in the research that we've done.
Yeah, it's a good question. So the question is, what's the diversity of the samples? And then the second part was around, sorry.
Just your thoughts on or what you've seen or heard or experience as far as like working with people who are not white, cis, het, upper class, middle class.
Right.
It seems to be the mainstream where most research subjects come from, depending on where you get the samples.
Yeah, yeah.
Just your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and you're highlighting something really important, which I think has plagued the research community probably since there was a research community. And I know I'm going to say some people are working on this, not everybody. You know, everybody's going to give lip service and say, yes, we need to diversify our samples. And some people are actually trying to do that. And some people are like, I just want to get my work done, you know. So, you know, those are my thoughts is like, I think we really do need to pay attention to that. And it's really important to increase our inclusion. In particular, you know, the scientific community has a terrible track record with African-American or Afro-descendant individuals in particular. And so there's a lot of mistrust with the community. And in fact, I've been doing a study for 2 years now where we were trying to make our unwinding anxiety program more inclusive, specifically for Afro-descendant individuals. We'd gotten a grant for this, and we were hoping to complete the data collection for it, you know, like within 6 months or something, because it didn't need a large sample size. And it has taken us forever because there is so much mistrust, even though in our research team is like all the people that are, I'm obviously not Afro-descendant, but our entire research team is Afro-descendant, which we felt was one critical for doing the design, but also for helping with the, just this history of mistrust. And even then it's been really, really challenging to do those recruitments. So I say that, you know, that's how far we have to go as a research community to just start to build trust in non, you know, white, middle, upper class, all the privileged folks. And we're going to need to do that extensively and consistently. And it's going to take a lot of time because this is an unintended consequence where it's like even folks that are trying to do the research, it makes it even harder to actually start to bring that inclusion in. So, you know, there's in our own studies, we try to, like if we're doing a local study in Providence, Rhode Island is largely white. And so even the geographic area makes it challenging to make sure that we have as much inclusion and diversity as possible. So it's a real challenge for the field, and we're feeling it, even though we've gone out and gotten specific grants to try to actually walk the walk. Yeah. So thank you for bringing that forward. My speculation on habit formation is that that has nothing to do with our skin color, you know, and I'm not trying, I just want to say that runs deep. Like habit formation runs deep for all of us. So no matter how much we might identify, there's certainly a lot of things that can affect our habit formation, you know, our conditioning, so to put it broadly. But this is a, you know, even back to the Buddha's time, this was a common thing. He didn't say, oh, this is just for the whatever caste. This is for all of us. He was actually apparently a rebel in that respect, that was kind of breaking down the whole caste system. You know, anybody can get enlightened, not just the Brahmins, for example. But I'm going way out. I'm not a historian. So if I said something that's absolutely wrong, please correct me. Okay, well, maybe we'll take one more, and then I think I'm happy to stick around for a few minutes, but also want to respect folks Friday evening so they can get out to the bars and the clubs and the reggae music. Did you have a question?
I think, but does anyone else have a burning question? Okay.
Please.
I'm curious, because you're also a psychiatrist, how the role of prescription medications also fit into this. I'm also very curious about kind of neurodiversity and OCD and ADHD, and actually medications kind of help create some chemical homeostasis to then be able to become more curious, or anxiety. And so just wondering how that fits into this puzzle as well for you.
Great. An easy question to end on. So I'll just repeat it in case the folks and zoomed in here. So what I think about medications, and there's medications, there's neurodiversity, and in specific, giving some examples of like ADHD and OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and things like that. So the first part, generally, I would say, for some people, medications can be very helpful. For everyone, learning how to work with their mind is very helpful. And so looking at anxiety, for example, about 1 in 5 people will show significant reduction in symptoms with the best anxiety medications out there, assuming they don't have side effects, blah, 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 blah. So it's like we're batting, one in five, 20%. So that's not great. And that's actually pretty good as far as medications go. If you look at cholesterol medications, I think it's like 1 in 40. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not giving any commentary. I'm just stating the facts, right? Yeah. So some people, medications, everyone can learn how to work with their minds. And that is also true. So I've not seen edge cases with these very deep learning processes certainly neurodiversity is important. And, you know, it highlights how you can't just put everybody into a single bucket. Having said that, one of the common buckets that we all have is learning. You know, it's how we form habits. And so that's such a deep process. There's going to be some, the trajectories aren't going to be exactly the same, but the learning, to a large extent, the process of learning is the same. And so somebody has ADHD or somebody has OCD, for example, they can still apply these same principles. You know, and for example, with OCD, that's like, you know, habit formation on steroids. Mm-hmm. And so we can still learn to pay attention, you know, explore gratification to its end, et cetera. With ADHD, especially if we're, you know, used to working with people with ADHD, we can bring in ways that neurodiverse individuals learn the best to emphasize these, you know, like how do we emphasize the gratification? How do we help them learn and explore that piece, for example, just as an example. So again, I see it as, you know, it's all good in the sense that these are general principles that the Buddha was talking about that we can all apply. But there's also, if you think of in Zen, they talk about 84,000 Dharma doors, right? So everybody's got an individual way that they're going to learn the most. And I think that's a beautiful example of neurodiversity. You know, 84,000 Dharma doors, right? We're all different in that respect. So does that get at your question?
Yeah, I guess, do you in your practice, do you utilize medication often as well supplemental, or is it oftentimes let's kind of learn about thinking first and then explore, I guess?
Over the last 20 years or so, my practice had largely been set up on the medication model. So it generally would start with medication, and then where somebody is open or there's a door that can be open, that's when I'd bring. So I wouldn't actually start with like, hey, let's, there's a guy named Buddha, you know, and he's like, I had 20 minute visits and they were coming for medication. So I start there to develop trust. And then like, if it doesn't work so well, or there's a doorway in, I would actually start to bring the stuff in afterwards. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. All right. Well, thank you all. We're a little over, so I want to thank you all. And I'm happy to stick around for a few minutes if you have any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all online. We're going to sign off now.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.